tuned in to the Community Cats podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Hey there, this is Kristen, the Community Cats podcast technical tabby. Our fantastic host, Stacey LeBaron, will be doing tons of Q&A in this episode, but I'm checking in with you to let you know that this is part two of a special podcast. It's the audio-only version of an advanced class that we held last year for Community Cat enthusiasts with friends of the show, Brian Cordes and Susie Richmond, and they are the resident experts at Neighborhood Cats. The webinar is called Colony Caretaking Tips and Tricks, and if you haven't listened to part one, you might want to go back a week in your podcast app and check that out. If you already listened to part one, awesome, you're going to love this week. Brian's going to walk you through how to build the perfect cozy winter shelter that doesn't stand out if you're in a really populated area. He's also going to tell you how to keep cats out of places where they aren't wanted, which is that angry neighbor's yard that had a beautiful garden until the neighborhood kitties learned it was also a great litter box. So you're going to be able to solve his problem while meeting the cat's needs and keeping them safe. And there's some fantastic little health hacks that'll help your colony stay in tip-top shape. Also, there's a super enlightening Q&A and conversation with Stacey at the end, so you'll definitely want to stick around for that. So if you like this and you want to check out the recording with all of the visuals, which are fabulous, Brian takes some great pictures, I set up a handy link for you guys, communitycatspodcast.com/everythingTNR, and that will take you right to our Everything TNR playlist, which is collected on our YouTube channel with full versions of all the free webinars that are presented by Neighborhood Cats. So if you like this, go check that out. Once again, communitycatspodcast.com/everythingTNR. In the meantime, enjoy the show. And don't forget that the goal of this podcast is to help you turn your passion for cats into action. And I hope you come away from this episode with a whole bunch of new ideas and inspiration to help you do just that.
Okay, so moving along now with our colony caretaker, we're going to move into a new subject area, and that's winter shelter, which is kind of timely, right, for this time of year. And, you know, it's important to understand cats are very good at finding places to shelter and to stay dry, but they do need help also staying warm, especially in very cold climates like the Northeast or, you know, the Midwest, things like, or Canada. So, you know, we want to provide that for them and make sure that they have a warm, safe place to sleep. Winter shelters, you'll see, they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes and materials and forms, but the good ones all share three qualities. One is obviously that they're waterproof, but also they're well insulated. And that means the material that the shelter is made of is capable of trapping and retaining heat. So think styrofoam is really one of the most popular kinds of shelter materials, that is. So, for example, if you get a doghouse and it's made of a thin plastic, you know, that will keep them dry, but it's not going to keep them warm. And you also want to have minimal airspace that's not filled in by the cats being in the shelter. Because what's happening in a winter shelter is the cats go in and they emit body heat. And the shelter, if it's a good winter shelter, is going to trap that body heat and warm up the space. So if the material that the shelter is made of is not good insulation, then that body heat is going to pass through the walls. Or if there's too much empty space, again, think of the large dog shelter, and you put a cat or two in there, there's still going to be a lot of empty space and too much for the cat's bodies to heat up. So you need to match the size of the shelter with the number of cats who are using it. So a shelter that might be great for four cats might not work really well if there's just one. The shelter you're seeing in this slide is one that you can easily make a similar type at home. It's a large styrofoam box. I think it was used for transporting fish. And it's wrapped in a kind of heavy industrial plastic, but you can get this kind of plastic at just get contract, what are called contractor bags at a Home Depot or Lowe's. And they're just very heavy duty bags that contractors and construction people use to throw, put their trash in. So it's not like the trash bags you're going to get at the supermarket, which are pretty thin and rip easily. Contractor bag plastic is much thicker than that. Now, in this slide, that plastic is attached to the shelter with plastic bands that are kind of welded on. So you don't need to get that fancy. You can just get some duct tape and wrap it around. A few bands of duct tape around the shelter will hold the plastic in place. Here's another kind that you can do. It's we call it the Neighborhood Cats Winter Shelter, and you can get the plans, detailed plans, by clicking on this link. And what it is, and you can see somebody obviously making one, it's a 2-foot by 8-foot, 2-inch thick piece of hard styrofoam, okay? And that, I'll say that again, it's 8-foot by 2-foot, 2 inches thick hard styrofoam. And it's mostly used for insulating attics or walls or things like that for home insulation. If you use our plans, you will take that piece of that sheet of styrofoam, cut it up into a number of pieces, and use every square inch to make this shelter by gluing all the pieces back together. The only downside to building this shelter is you have to have a table saw or be very good at cutting in straight lines, because if you just do a saw by hand or something like that, you're liable not to get nice smooth edges, and you'll have a lot of cracks when you glue the pieces together like you're seeing here. But it can be done, just take a lot more silicone to fill in all the cracks and things like that. This can comfortably hold the space you're seeing there, just to give you an idea of what, how much room you need inside your shelters. That shelter can very comfortably hold 3 cats and even 4. And in fact, there was one very cold morning where I showed up at the colony site early. I saw 5 cats come out of one of these. So that's what they do, is they get in there and they press up real close to each other, and they all become kind of heating sources for the whole space. And they stay it can be remarkably warm inside one of these if there's enough cats in there. There's another one that's even easier to make. You get your storage bin, cut a doorway in it like you see there with a box cutter, and you can get even 1-inch thick styrofoam sheets and press them against the floor of the storage bin and the sides. And you can see they don't have to be form-fitting, just loosely. They don't have to be pressed up exactly against each other, so you don't have to cut them exactly. And then you have a piece of styrofoam that goes on the top, and then you put the lid of the bin on, and boom, you've got your shelter. Pretty easy to make and very effective. Again, styrofoam boxes, you hear the word styrofoam coming up a lot because it's lightweight, it's great insulation. You can just take a styrofoam box, and like that food is shipped in, like this one, and just cut a door in it and put the top on and glue it on if you want to. If it's form-fitting, then don't glue it on, because you'll be able to, it'll be easier to keep the shelter clean if you can take the top off. And then just coat the thing with the deck paint. And that's a winter shelter that's good for at least 1 cat, probably 2. And we have Ferrovia if you just want to buy one and screw it together. And this is very well made. If you're in an emergency, like a storm is coming, and for whatever reason you don't have adequate winter shelter out, you can get by, at least for whatever storm is coming, with just cardboard boxes. And the way you can get, I'll go over it, but you can read the plans again. They're on our website. We have a feral cat winter shelter page that describes how to do this in detail. But basically, you're taking a cardboard box, then you're taking a smaller cardboard box and putting it inside, and then the space in between, you're stuffing with newspaper. So the newspaper is actually great insulation. So below the smaller, so you got a box in a box, and the box that's inside is being surrounded with folded newspaper or stuffed newspaper or whatever it is. Then you're taking a plastic drop cloth. Again, 3 millimeters thick is your best bet. And you're wrapping it around the outer box and using duct tape to keep it in place. And then, of course, cutting open a doorway. That's a great temporary winter shelter. One other thing to notice, well, a few things to notice from this slide, is how there's one shelter facing another shelter, and there's a piece of wood in between them. And you can see there's actually a black cat right in the middle there between the two shelters. You're creating a little, well, first of all, by having the doorways facing each other, you're blocking the wind. Having that little bridge between the two shelters gives a little space where you can put food and things like, and water, where the cats don't have to travel very far. and it'll be protected from the weather. Also notice how the shelters are raised off the ground just a little bit. And then finally, there are heavy objects placed on top of the shelters to keep them in place because they're very lightweight. So you don't want them blowing away. And look how big, they've got this big planter sitting on top of these cardboard boxes, but that's how strong the shelters are structurally, that they can withstand that kind of weight being put down on them. So I used this slide a little reluctantly because they didn't paint the shelters, right? So they kind of stick out like a sore thumb on the landscape. So maybe this is a good example of what not to do. You know, take a moment and paint them so they camouflage in. But maybe they didn't have to worry about that because it was their own backyard. You can see a couple of things here. Notice again how you have the wood spanning the shelters, or doorways are facing each other. And there's a piece of wood on top of both that is creating this protected area between them. Now, ideally, you can feed in that kind of hallway in between the corridor, between the two rows of shelters. If you're not doing that, then make sure your winter shelters are not that far from where the cats eat so that they don't have to travel a far distance in order to get there. And again, discreet is always better. So it's preferable not to have bright pink winter shelters. Of course, if they're covered with snow, like these are, maybe not as important. So what about inside the winter shelters? What do you put there? And they're what we call insulating materials. And the concept to understand about putting materials inside of a winter shelter is the way that they can make a cat warmer is if the cat can burrow into it. It doesn't make them warmer to lie on top of something. Like if you put a blanket on the floor, that's nice from it's soft, and they may appreciate that. But if that's all you have in there, it's actually going to make them colder, not warmer, because when they lie on top of it, the blanket will draw body heat out of the cat. It only provides warmth if the cat's under the blanket. So we don't want to do things like put towels and blankets and things like that and just lay them on the floor of the shelter. What you want is something like straw, which you can stuff in there, and then the cat can get in and just burrow his way. And so as he's sleeping, he's basically enveloped by the straw. That will make him extra warm. A lot of people confuse straw with hay. They're not the same thing. Straw is dry and hay is moist. Hay is a food for certain animals. You know, the straw is nothing, is not food. So because hay's like a food, it's moist and it can develop mold, which the cats can ingest through their noses and cause all kinds of health issues. So do not confuse hay with straw. Now, if you can't get a hold of straw, and you can usually get straw at Home Depot sells bundle straw, sometimes arts and crafts stores, especially around this time of year when there's all sorts of Christmas displays, you can buy little bundles of straw. So it's really not too hard to stables, not too hard to find. But if you are having trouble, you can use shredded newspaper. It will work just the same way. The cats are able to burrow into it. Now, there is a product. If you want to provide the cats with something soft to lie on that will keep them warm, it's this product called the Purr Pad. And there's a link to it at that where you can buy it at Petco. This is a material that's actually designed to not only draw body heat out from the cat, but then retain it and radiate it back. So it is like they're lying on a little, you know, warm blanket that's emitting heat. That's the one exception to the don't give them something that they just lie on. The Purr Pad is great. If you're in a super cold climate, you can use what's called Mylar blankets, which are those aluminum looking folded sheets in the middle of your screen. If you're in a cold climate, you should always have one of these in your car, because if your car breaks down in very cold temperatures and you're stuck for hours, you're going to want one of these to wrap around yourself, because they're super thin. They were developed by NASA originally, this material, Mylar, and it's super thin, and you wrap it around you and it traps all the body heat, and you can be quite warm in very cold temperatures. So what you can do with a cat winter shelter is line the walls and the ceiling and even the floor with Mylar blankets, just make sure it's glued really well in place. And then all the body heat that the cat emits is not only retained by the shelter, but the Mylar blanket then reflects it back at them. And this is a popular thing that a lot of colony caretakers, and for example, in Canada, use because of the extra cold that they experience up there. Moving on to another subject, and that's dealing with neighbors who don't want the cats around. So the easiest way to do that is just to help them keep the cats out. If it's a normal kind of backyard or garden, rather than argue with them about, you know, that the cats have a right to be there, and, you know, that doesn't usually end up helping the cats at all if you get into a confrontation. On the other hand, if you help them keep the cats out, then you've got a better working relationship. So there are two devices that are most popular in accomplishing this, and they both work off of the same kind of theory, which is motion activated. They emit these infrared fields, and when a cat steps into them, it sets the device off. So in the case of the ultrasonic device, it emits a sound that's highly irritating to cats. Now, it doesn't penetrate solid objects, so it won't bother your pet cats inside. It won't bother the cats on the other side of the fence. If you get this particular kind, the yard guard one, it won't bother the birds either. So most of the cats will just leave. Sometimes you get some that are stubborn and they'll try to stick it out. But after a week or so of listening to this, you know, irritating noise, they tend to go away. The motion-activated sprinkler, on the other hand, shoots out a burst of water when a cat steps into the infrared field. Doesn't get them wet, but it shoots it out in this kind of rapid-fire, violent way that frightens them. And what happens with both these devices is the cats learn the boundaries of the infrared field, and they don't step into that territory. After a while, you don't even need to leave them up. You might need to, once in a while, put it back on just to remind them. But they learn pretty quickly, don't walk over there if you don't want water being sprayed at you. Obviously, with the water, you would want to train the cats and set that up before you're in freezing temperatures. Otherwise, it won't work because it has to be hooked up to a hose. Now, with the ultrasonic devices, it's all about placement and using the right size device for the amount of area you're trying to cover and then placing them properly. And that's where people get tripped up because you can't see it working, right? Like with the sprinkler, we like them because you can see it in action. It's with the ultrasonic device, you can't hear it. So you don't really know if it's working or not necessarily. That's why we have one of our handouts is how to use an ultrasonic deterrent. And it's just a 3-pager with lots of diagrams. And if you follow those instructions, this device should work for you. Here's some examples of how you need to place it, an ultrasonic device, properly. So obviously, if this device has a 25-foot range, you don't want to try to cover an area that's 40 feet away. The device and its infrared pick up motion that's at within a certain height off the ground. So if you place these too high off the ground, the cats will go under the infrared field. So they shouldn't be more than about 6 to 8 inches off the ground. Another common mistake that's made. You want to point them in commonly, you know, frequented areas where the cats are going. Make sure the batteries are functioning and give it a little time to work. Like I said, most cats will just go away right away. There'll be a couple who try to stick it out, and you just have to be a little patient, and eventually they'll leave the area as well. Physical barriers are another way to deter cats from potentially harming property or staying out of gardens. Car covers are quite effective. You can get cat-proof fencing that's considerably more expensive, but if you want to go that route, this fencing is designed mostly to keep cats within areas, but you can also turn the tops of them around and keep cats out of areas as well. But it is a pricey product, although quite effective. There are cat scat mats, which are great for gardens and keeping cats out. The little rubber spikes, not sharp enough to harm cats, but certainly, you know, annoying enough to keep them out of the garden and stop them from digging. And you just press these into the ground. You can use lattice fencing, also prevents digging, and put your seeds in the openings of the lattice. And then river rocks, any type of rock of that sort will serve the same purpose here. These are for gardens, and basically you're preventing the cats from being able to dig which will stop them from using the garden as a litter box. Here's a combination of a couple of things that we came up with that worked quite well. Not the most sightly of things, but very effective at keeping the cats away. So, you know, the car cover protects the car, but what we found was the cats were, especially in the sunlight and the constant strong sun here in Hawaii, the car covers were getting brittle, and then the cats were able to get under them and they were ripping and this and that. So we combined a car cover with a couple of longer rolls of CatScat mats. And as you can see, just bungee corded the mats onto the top of the car. And that made it so the cats did not want to be on this vehicle and they stayed away and left it alone. An alternative, giving the cats another place to eliminate within the territory is also can be an effective strategy for, you know, managing their presence and not having the garden or parts of the yard used as their litter box. You just give them a big one that is more attractive. So one idea is this sandbox, and you can just get sandbox sand, which is very inexpensive, and just, you know, every however long you need to, however, you know, period of time, it could be 2 weeks, it could be a month, you know, dump the sand and put a bunch of fresh in or scoop it on a regular basis, whatever it might be, to keep it clean.
Have you ever wished your cat could talk to you? Well, get ready for an event that will help you better understand your feline friend's needs, thoughts, and feelings by observing their behavior. Join us on April 20th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. for the Community Cats Podcast annual Online Behavior Day. It's a full day packed with invaluable insights and expertise from our dream team of feline behaviorists, all focused on unraveling the mysteries of cat behavior. Dive into workshops covering a range of feline behavior concerns, from enrichment strategies and kitten training to tackling preventable behavior issues that can often lead to surrender and managing harmony in a multi-cat household. We'll even discuss pet safety. Alongside fascinating workshops, we're spicing things up with fun cat trivia and exciting prizes to keep you engaged and entertained throughout the day. Plus, you'll have a chance to network with fellow professionals and volunteers in the animal welfare sphere, sharing experiences and strategies to better the lives of our kitty companions. So whether you're a seasoned rescuer, a passionate volunteer, or simply a cat enthusiast eager to better understand your kitty, mark your calendars for April 20th and join us for an unforgettable day dedicated to understanding and improving feline behavior. Get all the details and register online today at communitycatspodcast.com/behaviorday. That's communitycatspodcast.com/behaviorday.
Ready for a grant challenge like no other? Mark your calendars for the Inclusive 2024 Open Arms Challenge. For the entire month of April 2024, animal shelters, foster-based organizations, and public charities are encouraged to create a new program or expand an existing one focused on keeping pets and people together. Learn more about how to register and important dates at maddiesfund.org. Tomahawk Live Trap exceeds customers' expectations by providing them with the highest quality humane animal control products available. Check out their new Pro Series Gravity Door Trap. They feature a door that sets automatically when you open it. No hook or plate setting needed. Use discount code KEEPITHUMANE for 10% off your order at livetrap.com.
Another idea is they like to eliminate in peat moss. So that should say pile of peat moss, not pile of peat box. Sorry, M-O-S-S. And that's a very inexpensive product you can get at gardening stores, and you put a pile of it in the corner of the yard, and that's where they'll go. And again, you can use one of our favorite objects, which is a storage bin, put litter in the bottom, cut a doorway, and have them go there. So basic ideas, give them somewhere more attractive to go than where you your garden or wherever you don't want them. Okay, our last topic we're going to go over today before we get to do some Q&A are health hacks. So we're not trying to dispense veterinary advice here. I want to be careful about that. If your cat is sick or injured or for whatever reason you're concerned about their well-being, obviously you want to try to get them to a veterinarian. These are more along the lines of how do you keep cats healthy so you don't reach a point where they need veterinary intervention. So it doesn't have to be, you know, costly or difficult. And you know, if you do some of these simple preventative things, you might save yourself some some big vet bills and some difficult trapping. So vitamin C is a great supplement for cats. Now, they naturally produce a certain amount of vitamin C themselves within their own systems. But in times of stress, that vitamin C is rapidly depleted. So you want to supplement it. So it could be harder weather. It could be before a trapping where their routine is disrupted. Anything that might cause them extra stress is going to cause them to use vitamin C up faster. And it's a good time to supplement it. It's also not a bad idea to just on a regular, it doesn't have to be daily, but even if in non-stressful times, to on a regular basis provide them with some extra C. If you can't overdose on vitamin C, it will just, the excess will just pass through their system. So how do you get them vitamin C? Well, probably the way that they would enjoy the most is organic tomato sauce. Because they, you know, a lot of cats love tomato sauce, and it just happens to be very high in vitamin C. What you want to do, though, is make sure there's no onion in the tomato sauce, because the onion can cause them a lot of damage. They're not able to, that can harm their kidneys. So get a tomato sauce that does not have onions or other, where it's just pure tomato sauce. You can also use powdered supplements, you know, powdered vitamin C supplements. It will have a little bit of a bitter taste, so you have to mix it in with something that's very tasty. And then you can give up to 250 milligrams, which is about an eighth of a teaspoon for each cat with each meal. That would be about the proper dosage. D-mannose is a supplement that's just not that widely known, but it's a great product for male cats who may be at risk of urinary issues, you know, blockages or bacterial infections. So when we see our male pet cats, if they start to look like they're straining and developing any type of urinary issue, obviously, if they're not passing urine, that's, you need to take them immediately to a veterinarian because they could be blocked. But short of blockage, if it's just starting out, we'll give them this product. It's a cranberry extract, and it often clears it up, in our experience, rapidly. So it basically eliminates that harmful bacteria. That's why, you know, sometimes when people have urinary tract infections, they drink a lot of cranberry juice. It's the same idea, only this is much, much more concentrated. And people can use this too. You'll have to consult with a dietitian about what the dosage should be. But with cats, you're looking at about an eighth of a teaspoon twice a day per cat. And it can be especially helpful for cats who are, you know, prone to these types of diseases to stop them from developing into major infections. You can also give cats probiotics, which promote healthy intestinal flora. That's the good bacteria. Our bodies have good bacteria, and sometimes if we're sick, they have bad bacteria. Problem with something like antibiotics is that they often kill both. So especially if your cats are being treated with antibiotics, it's a very good idea to try to get some probiotics into them to replenish that good bacteria that's in there. And again, you can add it to the food or water. Check the particular brand for dosage, but generally it's about a quarter of a teaspoon per day daily. And there's a million different brands and varieties out there that you can use. So what about fleas? Controlling them in a natural way. You can, again, go back to our good friend Diatomaceous Earth, although you're making sure that you're wearing a dust mask if it may get into the air. You can spread it into cracks and crevices inside the shelter, any areas where fleas may gather, and it will kill them on the contact. You can even rub it onto the cat through their fur, and that will kill the fleas too. And again, if the cats lick their fur and they ingest, as long as it's food grade, not the pool, it will not be at all harmful to them. Another way to control fleas naturally is what's called beneficial nematodes. And these are these microscopic, well, they're similar to worms. And basically, when you put them on a lawn, they just make their way through the lawn eating all the flea larvae that they can find. and they can clear up an area pretty quickly. The trick is to apply them properly, which is to spray over grass in shady areas during a cool part of the day. If you spray them in a sunny area in the middle of a hot day, they probably just die right away. Now, if you're looking for over-the-counter, more on the medication side for flea control, again, we're talking community cats, so we're assuming that you can't necessarily give them a dose of Advantage between their shoulder blades. So you need some way to administer the medication without having to touch the cat. There's a product called Capstar, and it basically you put it in their food, and within 15 minutes of ingesting it, all the fleas are dead. It doesn't provide longer lasting protection. It's not like Advantage where it will last for 30 days and kill all the flea eggs and kill any fleas that come on in the next month. It's just one and done. But it's a great way to kind of clear the cats. And if you do it periodically, it can be quite effective at not letting infestations happen. It's safe for kittens over 2 pounds. Its active ingredient, as you can see under the name Capstar, sort of the best known brand, but the ingredient is nitinpyrum. So there's a lot of generic copies of this that are exactly the same, substance. And they can often be quite a bit cheaper. So if you're searching on Amazon, check out Capstar, but then also do a search for nitinpyrum, and you may find that you'll save some money that way. Now, how about worms? Well, I haven't found, if you're holistically inclined, you can try that homeopathic remedy that is listed there on the right that you can get from Chewy. The jury's out on how effective that is. I haven't talked to enough people with experience of it to say one way or the other. So if you want to go more the standard allopathic route, you can get some really effective medication over the counter. There's Drontal, which is, again, for one type of worm. And then there's this tapeworm dewormer that you can get from Pet Meds also. I think Drontal covers more than just tapeworms. Anyway, you'll have to research a little bit before you buy the products to determine which one. But I know Drontal used to be something you could only get through a veterinarian, but it's quite effective at whichever type of worm it's aiming at.
So, well, this is my question, and many people might have asked these questions too with the car covers and stuff. We see so many, or at least I think I see on social media all the time about like, this kitty is stuck in the wheel well here. This kitty is stuck in the engine here. You've got a bang on the roof of your car engine. Is that really as much of a risk as we're seeing out and about on social media?
It's a risk if there isn't a warm place for the cats to sleep, because then they'll go and find one. And if they're near a parking lot or something like that, they may well seek the heat of an engine that was just turned off or something like that. So those kinds of incidents do happen. And it is smart in a cold climate in a parking lot, if there are cats around, to bang on the hood once or twice before you start the engine. That said, it's rare, but it does happen. Yeah.
So it's an okay practice, or a practice that makes sense, to go and bang on the car. And even if you are doing that car cover thing, the cat still can get up underneath. So that's still something to think about, or?
Yeah, they usually don't. If you bungee cord the car cover on, so it's not just flapping around loose, then they might try to get under it, but probably not. That
up under the bottom of the car into the engine underneath from the bottom.
Yes, that is possible. So if you're taking a car cover on and off every day, and you're in that kind of cold weather, it's just a real good idea to get into a routine of just bang the hood a couple of times and give them a second. That'll scare them and they'll run off.
We've gotten a couple of questions from folks who are feeding community cats, and they feel that they may be faced with moving down the road. How concerned should they be about trying to make plans for the future if they don't know that someone else is feeding that colony?
There's two parts to that question. One is like, should I get involved if I don't know where I'm going to be in a few years? Well, if you don't get involved in a few years, you probably have quite a few more cats to worry about. So, addressing that immediate problem is the number one priority. You know, stop the cats from reproducing. Now, in terms of how do you deal with if you might move or just, you know, being the only one, that can be really tough to be, you know, 7 days a week, you're the one responsible for those cats. So succession and having other people to work with makes it a lot easier. So you want to seek out neighbors and residents and friends. They don't necessarily have to live right there, but if they can come by. I know in New York, we have, you know, a network of caretakers all over the city. And when somebody's going to be gone for a few days, they post or they put up an email and ask if somebody can feed that colony while they're gone. And we can usually find someone. So, you know, researching social media and especially Facebook groups that are based in your area can be a great way to connect with like-minded people and to find that assistance. It doesn't have to be the person who lives right next door to you. In terms of if you're going to move and you're just not going to be there to care for them anymore, it's a common misperception that we're the only ones feeding these cats. Often these cats have multiple feeders, and when we do TNR projects, sometimes we find out that, you know, one cat's got four feeders and they all have different names for the cat. So that's not always the case, but in a neighborhood, there's often a number of people who are looking out for the cat. So it becomes a matter of talking to neighbors, passing out flyers, calling a local meeting about what do we do with the cats, do a next door meeting. Part of TNR, and we talk about this in the workshop, is what we call community relation. When you're dealing with community cats, you're not just dealing with cats, you're dealing with people. And if you ignore that part of it, it's going to make it harder for you, and it's potentially, you know, not as stable a situation for the cats. So get to know your neighborhood, get to know other people. There's no guarantee that you're going to find someone or it's going to work, but you have much more of a chance of that if you're being proactive and seeking out assistance.
I will say, if you own your property, it is a seller's market. And there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about people who put their houses on their market and contingent upon the sale of the house, they had to take care of the community cats in their backyard. And so if you do own your own property, don't be shy. Ask for support for those cats to go along with the house.
Yeah. I mean, especially in a seller's market, you can find yourself a cat lover. You know, and you give a little bit of a break, maybe help pay for some food over time. And that's a great way to find a substitute.
It was profiled as one of the more unique packages, but they're getting it more, frequently. People don't want to relocate the cats. They're part of the house. They're part of the community. And that's just part of the role that you play as you move in and join the community and the community support there. Question on feeding stations and shelters. How close or how far away should they be located to one another. Some people have opinions that they should be farther away. Other people think they should be close together. Your thoughts?
Well, I would say a lot of it is weather driven. So if you're in a cold climate and, you know, there's a lot of snow or things like that, then you don't want to make the cats travel a long distance to get to their food. The closer to the shelter, the better. Outside of those kind of wintry conditions, it really depends on the layout. There's nothing inherently better about the food being further away or closer, other than maybe they get a little more exercise walking across the yard. So a lot of that will just depend on the layout of the place and what makes the most sense. I guess you can make an argument if there's wildlife around that feeding further away from the shelters may keep the wildlife, make it less likely that they'll go into the shelters. So that might be a consideration too. I really think it's a kind of site-by-site decision. I don't think there's a blanket rule other than in really bad weather, you don't want to make them travel far.
And in terms of, you know, preparing for the bad weather, going way back into my Newburyport days where we were right on the waterfront and it was windy, wet, and cold, we always worked really hard in the wintertime to ensure that our shelters were facing away from the wind, very much, you know, the back. And we had our openings actually probably against the buildings, you know, so there was a little bit of an opening for the cats to get into the shelters that way. And we had our fuller feral feeding stations, which were those two level feeding stations. The feeding was on the top, and then there was a little bit of a shelter there, and we had extra shelters around. So there was a lot of variety and selection for different shelters, depending on how the cats, you know, could choose what they wanted to do. But we were always worried about the wind. I know we had lots of wind conversations. So if you are in an area that is very blustery, it's really important to pay attention to that issue and redirect your shelters, you know, for and preparing for storms. If you're preparing for something, some storm to be coming, you know, making sure that you're thinking about that, thinking about what you're going to have to shovel, you know, all the shoveling and prep, making sure you have a path identified, that you're not shoveling up and over different things, trying to have a straight path in there so that you can shovel and get to the cats' homes to be able to support them, you know, after a storm.
Yeah, absolutely. And that also goes towards, you know, having shelters raised up off the ground so that they don't flood, having heavy objects on top so they don't blow away, having two shelters' doorways facing each other, so that breaks mm-hmm. the wind. The better you can make them fit into their environment, the better. When you mention wind, sometimes the topic comes up about flaps. You know, do you put a flap over the shelter door? And I think it's important to understand that's totally optional. They're great if you can make them work, but they do take a little bit of work because you wouldn't want to put a shelter out with a flap on it that, and the cats aren't used to going into it yet, because that may stop them from ever going in. So first you want them to get used to going in and out of the shelter, and then you might duct tape or use like plastic nuts and bolts to attach, like maybe a piece of plastic that they can easily pull back to get in and out. But you don't want to try, and that'll help break the wind and trap more heat. Although, again, it's not essential. But don't do that until after they're used to going in and out. And when you first put them out, maybe sprinkle a little catnip inside to, you know, attract them to using it.
In Newburyport, we have like almost like a hard carpeting on the bottom, and they could slide in between it. But we didn't do that at every shelter. Again, it was variety was the spice of life. We just offered a variety to see what the cats would use. So we have that. Let me see. Last question. Okay, funding or how to find food to support your colonies and funding for spay-neuter. Any ideas?
Well, you know, when you get into the more costly parts of this, that's where having a group, like having a local nonprofit or something like that, can come in very handy. So, for example, you could put up an Amazon, as a nonprofit, you could put up an Amazon wish list and do a food drive and just get it out there. People love to donate in kind because then they know exactly what their money is buying, and people love to buy food. Same thing with funding. It's a lot easier to raise money as a nonprofit. But if you are working as an individual, one tip for you is check out your local pet store. They often have expired food that they can't return to the manufacturer. Expired food is usually perfectly good. And the way you know it's not good is it will smell horribly if it's gone bad. So they can sometimes be good at least a year after their expiration date. And again, it's not going to be a guess. If you open that bag or you open that can and it smells horrible, then obviously don't use it. Otherwise, it's fine. And they'll often donate it rather than just have it thrown away. That's one way to do it. You know, fundraising without a nonprofit is a much more limited, but you can just let people in your neighborhood know what you're doing. And I don't think you can solicit funds, unfortunately, but you can have that conversation, and often people will offer to assist you with it. But by far, the best thing to do is start a nonprofit if you want to get serious about fundraising. And it's not that hard to do. Don't hire a lawyer for thousands of dollars. Go to legalfilings.com or one of these online incorporation websites, and they'll do 90% of the work for you for like 10% of the cost of hiring a lawyer.
Great. Last question. And if folks are interested in other funding resources, they can certainly email me. I'm pretty good at brainstorming on that one. So you can email me at stacy@communitycastpodcast.com. But I know we are at 4:00. But here's a good one just to close us out. Is there a good rule of thumb for the amount of dry food per community cat per day?
Yes. Yeah. If you're talking about your average size cat, and we've got these numbers by surveying our community caretakers in our area, and it comes to about 1.5 pounds a week, or about 1/4 of a pound a day per your average size cat if you're just talking about dry food. So quarter pound a day, yeah, that'd be the best way to describe it. It'd be like a large cup would be enough for one cat for one day. If you're talking about canned food, it's a 5.5 ounce can a day. So now if a cat's smaller or much larger than your average size cat, then you have to adjust accordingly. But that's often how we can do population estimates, by monitoring how much cat food is being given. And that can get us pretty close to what the number of cats are using that quarter pound a day dry food for formula.
So there's a couple of questions about how to start a nonprofit out there. Just email me, and there was a presentation done on how to start a TNR program, which doesn't cover necessarily the how to start a nonprofit, but I think it's important for you to look at that in addition to, you know, you don't just start a nonprofit. I think you need to have an understanding of what that entails. What's that level of responsibility from a TNR perspective? So just feel free to reach out to me, and I can also get the general nonprofit setup information to you, as well as the access to the how to start a TNR program that Brian did along with Pat Dames of TNR Texas. I've done several years ago, but I think it's still very valuable and current content. So we're happy to share that information with anyone who is interested. Brian, again, what a wonderful, wonderful session. Thank you so very, very much, and appreciate it. We hope we'll see many of you at our December 2nd TNR certification workshop. And congratulations to those who won Cat Trivia. I'll send you access to the online Cat Conference. The recording of this session will come out in about 5 or 6 hours. So you'll see a link of that from GoToWebinar. And we'll also let you know when it's out on our YouTube page, but please subscribe to YouTube. If you need the handouts, you can email me. It's Stacy at Community Cats Podcast. And anything else, Brian, you want to share with the group today?
Just thank you. You know, thank you, because it is work and it's commitment. And, you know, they're just understand you're not alone. There are literally millions of us in this country. Reach out and tap into that network. And just thank you for the work you're doing every day.
Everybody, thank you so much for turning your passion for cats into action.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.